Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, people from across the country came together to march against the racism, hate, and violence that unfolded in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend. According to CNN, there were more than 130 rallies from Maine to California. Over the weekend, Charlottesville, Virginia became ground zero for hundreds of white supremacists, including neo-Nazi and KKK members. They came to Charlottesville to protest the planned removal of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. On Friday night, hundreds of torch-carrying white supremacists held a rally at the foot of the statue, chanting "White Lives Matter" and "Jews Will Not Replace Us." On Saturday, several hundred neo-Nazis, skinheads, and Ku Klux Klan members descended on Charlottesville with guns, shields, and clubs, Nazi-style helmets, Confederate flags, and Nazi paraphernalia. Many wore militia gear and held assault rifles. Others were wearing khaki pants, polo shirts, and Make America Great Again hats. Throughout the morning, clashes broke out between white supremacists and anti-fascist protesters. Things turned very deadly when James Field, a 20-year-old Nazi sympathizer from Ohio, rammed his car into a crowd of peaceful anti-racism protesters. He killed 32-year-old Charlottesville resident Heather Heyer and injured 19 others. According to reports, five are still in critical condition. On today's Your Call, we're going to get reactions to the violence in Charlottesville, what will it take to combat racism and bigotry, and in 2 weekends, a far-right pro-Trump group is planning rallies here in San Francisco and in Berkeley. So how should the Bay Area respond? Today, we're joined by Jeff Charlotte, Associate Professor of Literary Journalism at Dartmouth and author of several books, including his bestsellers The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, and C Street, The Fundamental Threat to American Democracy. Jeff has been reporting on the American right for 16 years. Hi, Jeff. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good to be with you.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Rochelle Riley, an award-winning columnist with the Detroit Free Press. Rochelle recently received the prestigious Ida B. Wells Award from the National Association of Black Journalists. Her forthcoming book is called The Burden, African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery. Hi, Rochelle. Nice to have you on. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you so much.
Well, I really want to start today's show by talking about the death of Heather Heyer and the injuries of 19 people and really the trauma of so many people who were there. I feel like the conversation right now is really being focused on Donald Trump. But first, Heather Heyer, a lot of people are writing about who she was. On her Facebook page, it says, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. She worked as a legal assistant in Virginia. Her mother has been speaking out saying that she's proud of what her daughter did. She says, I want her death to be a rallying cry for justice. Her mom's name is Susan Breaux. Rochelle, I want to start off with you. Can you just talk about just the importance of really talking about people like Heather Heyer and the others who were injured when that car slammed into them on Saturday?
Well, I'm glad that you started the conversation with the hero of this story, because we do tend to focus specifically on the reaction of a reactionary instead of on the people who are trying to keep America great. And she was one of them. I read the many stories about the way she was raised and the way she has always reached out to those less fortunate since she was a little girl. And the idea that she felt it important enough to stand up to something that she knew would debase freedom and one of the ideals that we live by means we really should be making sure to speak her name as often as possible. She sounds like she was an amazing woman, and I wish I had known her.
Mm. Jeff, what would you add?
I couldn't agree more, and I think the only thing that I would say, I don't know if we need to speak about heroes. We need to talk about citizens and ordinary citizenship. When we call her a hero, that lets the rest of us off the hook. We may not be heroes. We're just everyday people. So was she, and she showed up as we all must at this moment.
Mm. Well, I see it exactly the opposite way. I understand your point, and I think you're right, but I think that we have to make the ordinary extraordinary and all stand up and be heroes. So, yes, I don't mean that she was different. I mean that she was the best of us, and we should all rise to that occasion.
And I'll say that's exactly what there I agree. That's what I meant to say. Mm-hmm.
Well, now I would like to welcome Ross Matiga to the show. Ross was there. He watched as that car slammed into and killed 32-year-old Heather Heyer. He wrote about what he saw for Vox. Ross is a PhD student at the University of Virginia who researches the politics and the ethics of climate change. Hi, Ross. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, just watching the videos was traumatizing enough. I just want to ask, since you were there, how are you and your friends doing this morning?
Yeah, I mean, the whole city is, as you might imagine, very sad. Last night I went to a vigil with several hundred people in the town and people that were still in town from surrounding cities like Richmond, and the emotion there was palpable. I also would say that you know, it's difficult to try to describe what it is to see something like we saw this weekend right in front of you. It really defies a kind of normal emotional spectrum, and if it was meant to be terrifying, it was really terrifying. There was a lot of confusion, a lot of chaos, a lot of fear. So, you know, we're recovering. Really, my mind is with the many people that were injured. Among them were former students of mine. I talked to a student of mine this morning who's in the hospital with four of her friends who were, you know, the night before heroically holding out the Jefferson statue on the lawn against a crowd of white nationalists who then savagely beat them. Some of those same kids were later hit by the car on Saturday. So, you know, the town's really upended and scared. I mean, last night, even at the vigil, we had two vigils planned that got canceled because of fear of nationalists. So there's a kind of strange irony as we see across the country people having these solidarity civil protests, demonstrations, vigils, when we in our town still don't even feel safe about gathering together in large numbers to honor the people that were injured and killed.
You know, I think it's also important, Ross, to talk about the people who were peacefully marching before the car slammed into them. Because, what we're hearing on the media is the hard left. On Meet the Press, the National Review's Rich Lowry called it the violent fringe of the left. And I think we should spend some time talking about the people who were hurt. There's some really great media coverage out there. Unfortunately, because of our for-profit healthcare system, most of these people are launching GoFundMes, asking people to help them pay for their health care bills. So just a couple that I wanted to point out. 20-year-old Natalie Romero, she's just 20 years old, first-generation college student. She's recovering after being hit by that car. Her mother spoke to the media and said that she's on a full scholarship to the University of Virginia. She graduated from the ROTC in high school. That is the Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps, the federal military program in school. She's recovering in the hospital. She has a small skull fracture, multiple injuries to her face. There's also a story about DeAndre Harris. He's just 20 years old, and he says that if it weren't for his friends helping him, he thinks that he would have been beaten to a pulp. He also has a GoFundMe page to pay for his health care bills. And he writes, quote, "I arrived at Emancipation Park at 11 a.m. as a counter-protester to voice my opinion on racial tensions and to stand up for what I believe in. I was only there for a few minutes before I was hit with water bottles, maced with pepper spray, and had derogatory slurs hurled at me." He's black. And he talks about going into a parking lot, and he was dragged to steps, and he was just beaten with bats. There's actually video of DeAndre Harris being beaten. So, Ross, can you talk a little bit about this? Because there's all this talk about far left, you know, protesters there. But we're talking about DeAndre Harris, who's just 20 years old. The other woman I spoke about. Can you just talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's surreal again to see. Just, you know, I'm talking to you guys. You're in San Francisco. I'm in Charlottesville. It's real to have the attention paid to our little city that hasn't paid to it. But I think the real cost of that is media narratives can really flatten reality. You know, the truth is, what I saw was a beautiful coalition of the left form to hold back Nazi protesters in our city. Now, in Charlottesville, there's a surprisingly thick network of progressive community organizers. They prepared for this day. They had two parks reserved that ended up being kind of like fallback grounds for a lot of the counter-protesters that were there that day, McGuffey and Justice Park. You know, my friends helped get those permits and organize those parks. There were groups from all over the state and all over the country that came in solidarity with us. And now, you know, when we talk about the alt-left or the far-left or the fringe left, I think there's a strange way in which that's trying to draw a kind of false equivalency between people who think that racism is bad and people who want things that are civil, like universal health care, and people who are calling for the extermination of non-white people. Mm. So, I mean, we have to be very, very careful about using terms like alt-left. The leftists that I saw in the city, of which I count myself a proud part, they were marching in nonviolent solidarity with people of color, with the rest of the town, who were honestly terrorized by the largest demonstration of white supremacists I've ever seen, and it seems to have been one of the largest demonstrations in decades. Now, I'll point out, you know, among the quote-unquote fringe on left are clergy, students, people that, you know, one thing that I'd really like to play up, and one of the reasons why I agreed to come on the show today, is that I saw some remarkable, remarkable heroism in the city. I saw clergy like Dr. Cornell West, Dr. Reverend Tracy Blackman, stand arm to arm with people I've known for a while in this city, people that trained, prepared for this moment, linked arms in front of Emancipation Park to keep out the Nazi protesters, stood right up to like armed militiamen who had huge guns. And if it weren't for the, you know, quote unquote, you know, far left fringe radicals, I guess, stand between the clergy and those militiamen, in Cornell West's words, they would have been crushed like cockroaches.
Mm.
You know, the clergy held their ground. The students the night before held the ground, didn't give the Nazis another photo op in front of a statue in our city. When that car hit the crowd, what I saw among the pandemonium was people screaming for medics, and I saw just normal, ordinary human beings run into the area where the car had just hit. Even though at that moment, you have to, you know, it felt like a bomb had gone off. People were afraid that other cars were going to hit. You know, we're walking by parking garages, the same parking garage where that young man got beat. We saw Nazis hailing Hitler, saying, "Hail Trump," "Sieg Heil," out the side of these parking garages, looking down like spotters. There was a real sense like this was a coordinated attack and that it could be repeated, and yet people ran right into the thick of it to give assistance to people. Part of that had to do with the fact that there was not really a lot of emergency service personnel on that side of the town.
Wow.
But part of it had to do with the fact that, you know, this quote-unquote alt-left or fringe left or whatever, these were just normal people who were responding to a very real threat, and I think doing so in a very honorable, nonviolent way.
And a lot of brand new college students. Rochelle, what would you add to this very important point that Ross is talking about?
Well, I can tell you that beyond the horror, because it was really so hard to feel as you were watching it, I truly couldn't believe this was happening. I was in New Orleans watching it all on television, so I just literally had to pray for the people who were there in the middle of it. But when I saw these young people, it gave me such a sense of pride. People tend to dump on millennials and to dump on 20-somethings as not being very involved, wanting to live off their parents, all of those generalities that people toss out that, of course, aren't all true. But to see these young people, which means a new generation is fighting for the kind of freedom that, you know, our heroes have been fighting for forever, that was such a moment of Americanism and such a point of pride, and it gave me a sense that all is not lost, and that some of this feeling of despair that we have been feeling since last November's election, and this is not about Trump, this is just about the election and the post-election permission that some people decided to take to use it for their own hatred. I can't say that Donald Trump encouraged it. I can't say that they weren't just looking for somebody to hang it on to, but it has happened. There's been a rise in hate crimes. There's been a rise in this type of anger. And what we saw were people who used to wear hoods, who feel like they don't have to wear them, who were out to harm people. And to see these young people stand up to them, let me know that America's going to stand firm.
Jeff, what would you add?
I think it's worth pointing out, though,
Ross,
just to be clear, that those people that, you know, they were there closely associating themselves with Trump. Some of them were wearing white polo shirts and khakis with a red hat like Donald Trump wears at the golf course. Some of those white polos had Trump golf course logos on them. They were saying, "Hail Trump." Now, I should also point out that two of the rally's organizers, shamefully also UVA grads, makes me very sad to say that, Richard Spencer and Jason Kessler, there's innumerable pictures with them with Virginia GOP, with our local House of Representatives guy, Tom Garrett, with Corey Stewart, who just very, very narrowly lost the Republican primary, running pretty openly as a white supremacist here in Virginia, and who is now challenging Tim Kaine for the Senate seat. There's pictures of the same rally organizers with these GOP guys. I definitely don't want to reduce this to Trump's comments. I definitely don't want, but the feeling on the ground was these people were emboldened by Trump. They were standing there in solidarity with Trump. They understood themselves to be carrying out, yeah.
Jeff, you have been covering the far right for 16 years. Help us make sense of this, because we saw neo-Nazis, KKK members, people who were more armed than the police in Charlottesville. They were carrying rifles, Nazi-style helmets, Nazi paraphernalia, saying things like, Jews will not replace us. Can you put this in context for us? What are we really dealing with here?
Well, I think Ross and Rochelle are absolutely right when they say they're emboldened by Trump, and we don't need to do any deep interpretation. We just need to look at their own words. Websites like the Daily Stormer, a prominent neo-Nazi site, saying this is terrific, and Trump's response was terrific. He said very, very good. So we see that happening, but we also don't want to lose sight, and we don't want to get sort of too trapped in the moment that Trump is the problem, because this problem is as old as America. The problem of white supremacy is baked into this cake as going as far back, and specifically this kind of nod and wink between the establishment right and the militant in the street right. That's an old practice as well, and you can see it happening right now. Look beyond Trump to the states like Tennessee and Florida that have recently introduced legislation that would decriminalize a driver hitting a protester in the street. Mm-hmm. They have actually tried to decriminalize what just happened in Charlottesville. Some of those people are Trump supporters. Some of those people pushing those bills are never Trumpers. This problem, we need to sort of focus on the moment and the way Trump emboldens it. My concern is that the left gets caught up in the idea that if we can just get rid of Trump, everything will be okay. No,
right.
These problems are old, old and deep.
Yeah, Rochelle, what would you add to that?
I couldn't agree more. I just want to say that while we can't let the president off the hook, we cannot make this about one person, because this problem is hundreds of years old. This is a problem that America has never dealt with. And people like this, hateful people who literally are committing acts of terrorism, have been looking for excuses for ways to take it to the streets. They will take whatever route they can. And in this case, they decided to go through Charlottesville. And they were aided by the president's words yesterday, and they have been aided by GOP members for years. I was raised in North Carolina, the home of Jesse Helms. So let me tell you, there are people who are elected officials who are doing the same thing that Trump is doing. They just don't tweet 140 characters every day.
Ross, I know we have to let you go, but before we do, on August 26th, a group called Patriot Prayer, they were in Seattle last night. They're a far-right pro-Trump group. They're planning to come to Chrissy Field in San Francisco, and then the next day they're planning to go to Berkeley. Based on what you saw over the weekend, a lot of people are debating the response. How do you think people should respond to these groups?
Well, I went to a sermon at 8 p.m. At St. Paul's, right across from the Rotunda on Friday night, and I went to the Sunrise Sermon that Cornel West did at 6 a.m. at the First Baptist Church in town right before the protest. And at both of those, two messages came clear. At the 8 p.m. sermon, Dr. Tracy Blackman, she had the main comment. She gave the main sermon. And her message was one of radical solidarity, one of understanding the interconnectedness of all progressive issues, understanding that we can't stop at combating white supremacy, that really white supremacy is embedded in a larger logic of oppression, domination, subjugation, cultural imperialism, and so on, and that we have to stand together. We have to stand together in opposition to this. Cornel West, his message the next morning was one of understanding that the very real risk that we're facing in confronting this issue, but the fact that we cannot back away from it. So my personal feeling is, the clergy walked out of that First Baptist Church that morning after Cornel West had said, we're going to be risking our bodies, we're going to be risking arrest, we're going to risk getting shot. Everybody hoped for something other than that, but those expectations were real. And they went out and held their ground, and they did that to bear witness to the terrible injustice that's happening. We can't surrender to them. We can't allow this kind of fear to grip us. Last night in town, there was a real debate about whether or not to have a vigil because of the threat, the credible threat of neo-Nazis coming back again.
Mm-hmm.
We went out, and hundreds of people gathered at the precise corner that Heather was murdered and held hands and sang together. So my feeling is, we live in very, very dangerous times. Everybody should do what they're comfortable with doing, but we can't put our heads in the sand. We can't be afraid of confronting these kinds of issues because they're not going to go away until the left stands together in solidarity on these issues.
Well, Ross, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your story. And let's hope everyone, the 19 people who are in the hospital and the 5 who are in critical condition, have a speedy recovery.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for discussing these issues. They're important.
Thank you so much. Ross Mittiga watched as that car slammed into and killed 32-year-old Heather Heyer on Saturday. He wrote about what he saw for Vox. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're also joined by Jeff Charlotte, Associate Professor of Literary Journalism at Dartmouth. He's been reporting on the American right for 16 years, and Rochelle Riley is an award-winning columnist with the Detroit Free Press. And like I said, a far-right pro-Trump group called the Patriot Prayer is scheduled to come to San Francisco on August 26th, Chrissy Field here, and then the next day at Berkeley at MLK Park. And before we go to break, let's hear from a caller who wants to talk about how the Bay Area should respond to this. Let's hear from Donald in Berkeley. Hi, Donald. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose, and thank you for this very important show. I want to say two things. There's a brand new film that has not yet been released, but is going to open at a major festival very soon. It's called The Long Shadow. Your listeners can go to the website, thelongshadowfilm.com. It's about slavery, white supremacy, and the role of the South in shaping the politics and the history of this country. So it's extremely timely. I'm a resident of Berkeley for the last 2 days. I've been calling on Berkeley City officials through email, Facebook, etc., saying we should not allow hate speech to come to Berkeley. We should take all legal measures to prevent them from coming and inciting, just as they did in Charlottesville and just as they've been doing up and down the northwest of the United States for the last several months, including Berkeley, Portland, Seattle, and Sacramento. This is a coordinated strategy on the part of the right. And they are clearly targeting the blue states here in the Northwest to create provocation and beyond, and to assert their power, as your previous speakers noted. And I think it's important for officialdom of both San Francisco and Berkeley to say, not in our town, we're not going to allow this to happen.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. We're going to take a quick break, and coming up after the break, we will take your calls to get your response to what is happening in Charlottesville and beyond. Heather Heyer was killed on Saturday. She was a 32-year-old standing up to white supremacist violence and racism. She was hit by a 20-year-old Nazi sympathizer who intentionally drove his car into a crowd of peaceful protesters. Over the weekend, we saw people wearing military gear with assault rifles. They had shields, they had clubs, helmets, Confederate flags, Nazi paraphernalia. Many said white lives matter and Jews will not replace us. So we're going to get context about these groups. Who are they? There were some people who were older, a lot of younger people wearing khakis, white polo shirts, and those red Make America Great hats. So we're going to talk more about who these groups are, how organized they are, and also what is drawing such young people to neo-Nazi and KKK movements. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. can go to the telephone or you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or by going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call us toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about how people should respond to white supremacy in Charlottesville and beyond. And we're talking today with Jeff Charlotte, author of the bestsellers C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy, and The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Jeff has been reporting on the American right for 16 years. Rochelle Riley is an award-winning columnist for the Detroit Free Press. She just received the Ida B. Wells Award from the National Association of Black Journalists. Her forthcoming book is The Burden, African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What was your reaction to the tragedy and the violence in Charlottesville over the weekend? How do you think that people should respond? For example, how should we in the Bay Area respond in the coming weeks? What is the best response to these groups? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Jeff, let's spend a little bit more time giving people context. Like I said, there were lots of different groups at this rally. Some people were heavily armed. There were older people who had Confederate flags. And then there were a lot of young college students who were wearing the khakis, the white shirt, and the Make America Great Again red hats. Can you just give us some context about these different groups? How organized are they? Where do they come from? What do you know about them?
The good news is they're not nearly as well organized as the events of this weekend might lead us to fear. The bad news is that they're getting there. They are pushing hard on college campuses. It would be ridiculous to saying they're finding mass response, but they don't need mass response. These are guys who subscribe to the idea of an avant-garde. They don't need big numbers. They need a small numbers that can make a big noise, and that's what they've got. And you see that with groups like Vanguard America, which is the organization that fields the driver of the car, may or may not have been associated with. They're now saying that he had nothing to do with them, despite the fact that he was photographed marching in their uniform and carrying one of their shields. The uniform is white polo shirt and khakis. You saw some of these pictures. They look pretty dorky. I think one of the mistakes that we often make is looking at these guys and thinking, what fools, they're not very dangerous. As they proved yesterday, they are very dangerous, despite being ridiculous. Mm. And despite that history, you know, I spoke before, the nod and wink between establishment right and the street right. We don't really need to get into figuring out which politician believes exactly what. We need to pay attention to the fact that with what happened yesterday, suddenly we had guys like Ted Cruz being applauded for his brave stand against racism. Well, the Senate has slouched rightward. It allowed for the far right of Ted Cruz to suddenly become moderate because he's not killing people. And that's how it's always worked. And it's also worth knowing when you look at these organizations and David Duke and so on, they understand that. They understand that the role that they're playing. Even as they deride establishment right as cucks and cuckservatives, they understand they're making it possible for those slightly less militant than them to move in their direction.
We should also say that David Duke was at this rally when Trump tweeted, "We all must be united." David Duke, the former KKK Grand Wizard, said, "I would recommend you take a good look in the mirror and remember it was white Americans who put you in the presidency, not radical leftists." He also spoke at the rally. Rochelle, what would you add?
Well, I think Jeff is exactly right. We have to watch this use of terms. Every time I hear the term alt-right, I cringe because there's right, there's far-right, and there's very, very dangerous. And the more the dangerous get a foothold, whether it's a spark in Charlottesville or what may or may not happen in the Bay Area, that means all of these people who are just shy of dangerous have some leeway and have an opportunity to do their own damage. And what we have to do is to make sure we don't have this to happen everywhere. This seemed like a small group of people who went somewhere and caused some trouble and caused some harm, but this was a huge monumental shift. If this is allowed to happen over and over in different places around the country, we are headed down a path that we do not want to go down.
Rochelle, can you also talk about the politics behind all of this? I mean, the Republicans have a long-standing tradition of harnessing white racial resentment to win elections, from the infamous welfare queen rhetoric of Reagan to Newt Gingrich labeling Obama the food stamp president during the 2012 elections. And then the past election cycle has been incredibly vicious. Trump has given, you know, so many white people a reason to believe that they're the most oppressed people in society. Can you talk about just what your thoughts are, how you're analyzing these political shifts?
Well, I'm not the first one to have said it, but Donald Trump is not the problem. He's a symptom. And he's a symptom of a problem that's been decades in the making. As you said, this has been a political strategy for a long, long time. And I think that one of the things that's very dangerous about this particular situation is all of these people who have been looking for a savior and for someone who they can use, not just to serve as their leader, de facto or not, but to hang their hate on so that they now have a right to have a seat at the party. You know, they have been ostracized and moved out a little because they're not really American. They're not really a part of this amazing strategy that we've had for a long time to bring the huddled masses here and have a diverse America. They now see an opportunity. When Donald Trump said, "Let's take back our country, let's make America great again," every white nationalist, and not an expert like Jeff is, but every white nationalist, I'm sure, across the country said, finally. Now, I don't know whether Donald Trump meant that when he said it, but I know there are several elected officials, some of them in my home state of North Carolina, who were thrilled. I know that there are people who do want that to be America, and I think that we have to be careful to make sure that we don't allow a small group of people to become a large group of people, some of them wanting violence, some of them not, who want to change the country.
Jeff, what would you add?
You know, I think Rochelle is right to sort of invoke the dog whistle of history and quotation marks there. And when we look at Trump's first response, and, you know, condemning violence on many sides, and we, so many of us were sort of so disturbed by that, we weren't paying attention to the other thing that he said in that response, which was we must honor our history. That was the dog whistle. That was the language that it's hard to believe is even Trump's. You look at the people writing speeches for him, Stephen Miller, Sebastian Gorka, maybe Steve Bannon. These are the guys who understand the power of that invocation of history. And that's the same thing that the white nationalists in Charlottesville were talking about. They think they're defending history. So they think they are sort of have this great ocean of the past behind them. And it tells us that some of the struggle must take place in the streets, some of the struggle must take place at the ballot box. Some of it, though, must take place with all of us getting better educated about history. So when they invoke history, we can say right away, no, Robert E. Lee was not an honorable general. Robert E. Lee defended slavery and explicitly defended slavery. We can shoot down those myths that he hated it but fought only for Virginia. We need to be versed in history and confront this on every level, including the fact that this isn't the first time there's been mass rallies of Nazis. You go back to Madison Square Garden, 1939, filled with the American Nazi Party. Those sympathizers have always been there.
Well, and also recent history, because, I mean, mass incarceration also has a lot to do with this and is connected. In 2015, Bill Clinton conceded that over-incarceration stems from his policies, the 1994 three-strikes provision, mandating life sentences. I mean, we've just seen an explosion. So we shouldn't say that it's just Republicans, right, Jeff?
No, yeah, and I was thinking that as we were discussing that earlier, and certainly Bill Clinton's own welfare rhetoric, you know, helped set this stage. We don't have to go back to the Dixiecrats to find all the ways in which Democrats have also played their own version of the Republican Southern strategy, and calling out to not the explicit white supremacist, but the sort of the suburban white supremacist, the kind of person who would say, I don't even know what that term means. And yet they have this sort of dull feeling and anger that somehow they're discriminated against. I see this in my own students at Dartmouth College, not all of them, of course, but students who feel that somehow white students who feel that African-American students have been given an unfair advantage in admission. That's the same spectrum. That's the same story. A lot of those people are not going to be carrying swastikas. They might even be voting for Democrats. But they're the people that we need to contend with just as much as the Nazis in the street.
Jeff Charlotte is Associate Professor of Literary Journalism at Dartmouth and author of the best-selling book C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy, and The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Jeff's been reporting on the American right for 16 years. Before we get to calls, Jeff, when your students say these things, how do you respond and what does the dialogue sound like?
You don't hear that kind of thing too often explicitly in class, only once or twice, and we shut down class and we confronted it head on. Where that happens, and I think there are campuses where you do, but these are smart kids, and the right wingers are smart too, and they sort of understand that there are things they can't say in class. And they feel that they're being censored. So a lot of that discussion on censorship, well, no, it's true. You can't say that your non-white classmate was given an advantage in getting in over you, because that's actually not true. That's the bias we have in our classroom. We have a bias toward accuracy and facts, and we confront that. But where it happens, where students are hearing it, is in conversation, and that's when students of color are coming and saying, look, this is something I've been confronted with. How do I address it? Mm-hmm. That is an ongoing struggle, and I don't think there are any easy answers to any of this, including, you know, how should Berkeley respond? How should any of us respond? There's no clear answers right now. We need to be pressing on many fronts and finding out what works.
Yeah, Rochelle, what would you add?
Well, I just want to remind people, and when you say these things out loud, people bristle, but that doesn't make them less true. America was birthed and grew up and became great on a doctrine of white supremacy, and some of this is old and ingrained and is worse in some place than others, and it's something that we've had to fight against as Americans, not just as African Americans, Native Americans. And if we're not careful, we're going to have a lot of people wishing for better things, even if they don't identify with those people who would drive a car into a group of peaceful citizens trying to make sure that they don't spread their hate. So like Jeff said, this is the time for every person who watched this on television or who's been listening to reports of this on the radio to decide where they stand. Do you want to be a part of the America that grew out of that old America, or do you want to be a part of that hateful America which will not last? And everybody get involved.
Rochelle Riley is an award-winning columnist with the Detroit Free Press and author of the forthcoming book, The Burden, African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery. You can join us at 866-798-8255. What do you make of what happened over the weekend? What about the larger questions that we're raising on today's show? These groups plan to come to the Bay Area and Berkeley, San Francisco, I should say, specifically, in two Saturdays, and then Berkeley in two Sundays. How should the Bay Area respond to this? The email is feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio. And let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yeah, I want to say that free speech was never meant to be a right to threaten the existence of another group of people. Free speech was never created with that intent. So people need to learn about what free speech is all really means. When a group of a mob of white people screaming blood and soil with tiki torches is marching down the street, and when the history shows that those group of people have actually really killed people, not only history, but contemporarily as well. You know, there's no right to free speech. That's not free speech. And also, I find it very ironic that CNN would have put an Israeli representative as defender of civil rights and denouncing anti-Semitism when they themselves treat Ethiopian Jews black Jews like pariah and put them in concentration camps when Israel is not the paragon of civil rights, even in their own apartheid country. So, I mean, I find it ironic that Jeff Sessions, of all people, would be in charge of a civil rights investigation. This is like almost, it is just incredible. I mean, it's.
Well, thank you for calling in, Lisa. On the point about free speech, Jeff, a number of people here in the Bay Area are starting to call public officials to say you should not give permits to a group that is clearly coming to your town to incite violence. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that tactic is just fine. If you want to call your public officials and urge them to do that, that's free speech. I guess I have to respectfully disagree with the caller and say, if you want to carry a tiki torch and chant blood and soil, that is exactly what the First Amendment is for. And even before that, Roger Williams and the idea of liberty of conscience. Now, if that means if you're someone like some of the people who were in Charlottesville are people who really do have records of violence and people who came with weapons. Free speech doesn't include them. But it does include that ugliness, and I am in favor of the roar of free speech that comes back when much, much, much bigger crowds come out. And I think one of the things that's happening right now is that free speech is sort of being claimed by the right when we see protesters come to shout down a right-wing speaker, mm-hmm. and they say, that's not free speech. You know, shouting down a speaker, that's free speech too. I'm okay with that. I'm not too crazy about giving authorities the right to decide which political group can march and which can't. I think that's another situation where we're letting ourselves off of the hook. We have to show up as citizens, and it's up to us to shut down that event.
Rochelle, where do you stand on that?
I stand with Jeff. I think that the only thing that public officials can do is to challenge laws that allow people to show up with guns. I think that you cannot allow one group of people to have a say and not have the other, and as much as some of the things they might say may be monstrous, this is America, and if we're going to have free speech, it must include everyone. I just don't think that you have to be a part of setting up something that you know can lead to someone being harmed. And when I saw the arrival of those people called them militia. You know, you never know who's really a militia or not. But when I saw people armed and saw people with baseball bats, they're coming for violence. You can do something about that. That's what law and order is for, and that's what authorities are for, and that's when you start to arrest people immediately. But for speaking and for saying whatever ugly thing you want to say, you have as much right to say that as I have to say, I will not fall prey to your level of hatred.
Joy writes in, what would happen if we blacklisted these far-right demonstrations? No press, no people protesting them, no publicity at all. The attention, the outcry, the publicity feeds them and draws others to their movements. I'm not saying to not protest or speak out and defend against their ugly movement of hate, but not to give them what they want from these protests, the attention, the fights, and the publicity. We're getting a lot of emails, Jeff, from people who say they should be ignored.
You know, I think people are saying they should be ignored before the attack in Charlottesville, and I think that's sort of pretending that's imagining that we of the left are more of the center than we really are, that we can just ignore them and they will go away. It's ignoring the fact that the right occupies the government right now. You can't ignore your own government, the people in charge, and you never could. You never could. I think as tempting as that solution as it is as reasonable as it is in our personal lives to sometimes walk away from a bully, I think it's worth recognizing those moments in history where the right is powerful enough that kind of civil, sort of nice kind of civil dialogue solution isn't going to work anymore, and we need to confront them somehow. That doesn't mean that everyone should be taking up the methods of Antifa. It doesn't mean that there needs to be street fighting, but it does mean that historically that tactic isn't going to work right now.
And another listener, Ruby, says, I loved that your eyewitness Ross spoke of the nonviolent bear witness approach to meeting marchers who are violent, are interested in hurting others, are armed and ready. I've been thinking a lot about this the past couple of days and about Martin Luther King Jr. Ruby says he would want us to be there in huge numbers bearing witness, and that's how I think we ought to meet the upcoming marches. Rochelle, what do you think?
Well, you know, the journalist in me has to speak first, and I have to ask people, I have to tell people, you can't have it both ways. If you think that these folks, many of them, some of them, are spurred or empowered by the President of the United States, we cannot, as the media, not be there to see if that's true. We cannot not report on what's happening. I don't know that in this instance, the media not being there would have made any difference at all, because the people who went there with a certain intent. I do think that there are things that we can do as the media before something like this happens. I don't think that you necessarily in this country before the past 2 years gave equal treatment to this fringe group on the far, far right and all the rest of the political parties. We've elevated their rhetoric, hateful as it is, in a way that is dangerous and that, you know, is kind of a new McCarthyism where you let somebody who shouldn't really have such a bully pulpit have a lot to say. Those are the types of decisions you can make, and those are the types of things that we can do. And I noticed that Mr. Spencer is not on television as much as he used to be, but I don't think in the moment of something like that happening, you can expect the media to pretend like that's not happening, and then you turn on the television and say, oh my God, what happened in Charlottesville, and why don't we know?
We have another email from Sandy who says, one thing to do, demand Trump fire white supremacists in his administration, Steve Bannon, Stephen Miller, and Sebastian Gorka. Today we are talking about what happened in Charlottesville, but it's not going to end in Charlottesville. A number of groups are planning their rallies here in San Francisco in 2 Saturdays and in Berkeley in 2 Sundays. There's a lot of talk right now about what the response should be. We're also just talking about the larger issues of this white supremacist movement. There were some identified militia groups in Charlottesville on Saturday that showed up fully armed and in uniforms, carrying assault rifles. There were a lot of young people with khakis, white polo shirts, and those red Make America Great Again hats. So if you have any questions, comments, something to add to the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, tweet us at Your Call Radio. Jeff Charlotte is joining us, Associate Professor of Literary Journalism at Dartmouth. He's been writing about these issues for 16 years. Rochelle Riley is an award-winning columnist with the Detroit Free Press. Jeff, I wanted to ask you, the photos of these young guys are going around. Again, they had nothing on their faces. So young, 20 years old. Have you done much research looking at what pulls them into these movements? A high school teacher has been speaking out, the high school teacher of James Fields, the 20-year-old who rammed his car into a crowd of peaceful anti-racism protesters, said that he dabbled in, you know, Nazi history, and he tried to get him out of it, but he failed. So can you talk a little bit about specifically about these young men?
Yeah, I think one thing that's fascinating when you start sort of looking at these circles is the ways in which a lot of them experience their research in quotes as a form of intellectualism. And they feel like these aren't just guys who are raving and frothing. They feel like I'm the one who goes to the library and looks up books and reads Mein Kampf, you know, Hitler's manifesto. And I think you see that same trend emerging from some places that aren't necessarily out-and-out sort of Nazi sympathizers. For instance, some years ago, I did a big survey of all the textbooks being, American history textbooks being used by private homeschooling associations and Christian academies, many of which, in fact, the biggest supplier of these textbooks, specifically celebrate the character of Confederate generals like Stonewall Jackson and Robert E. Lee, even as the textbooks would decry slavery, they would say, in fact, these guys were really opposed to it too. But it was creating this model. You saw the same thing. We see these texts that are coming from mainstream texts like Braveheart, which is described on the far right as the most perfect white nationalist movie ever made and something they look at again and again, or big bestsellers like Wild at Heart, not related to Braveheart, which recommends that wives give their husbands swords to honor their male headship. Those ideas are actually mainstream ideas. They probably sound pretty silly to the listeners of this show, but that's a book that sold millions of copies. You can find it in your local library. You can find it anywhere. And it's not a far leap from the idea that you should have a sword and that you should be like Mel Gibson in Braveheart to these guys who are carrying shields in the streets with medieval insignia on them. And you see, in fact, even almost... You know, if you're a Game of Thrones watcher, well, you're one tenth of the way to the appeal. That I'm not bashing that show in particular or anything at all, but this idea of the kind of medieval fantasy, I know this kind of final battle that is very appealing to a lot of these young testosterone-laden guys.
Jeff, I'm so glad you brought this up, because when you hear these people say, we want our country back, you have to wonder what they learn in school about Native American genocide. Have you looked at that just briefly?
And I mean, I know the Christian conservative circles more, which is where a lot of them emerge from, though not all by any means. There, they don't learn much about that at all. They learn instead about, you know, what that history frames as the great missionaries who brought the light to the savages. So it wasn't a genocide. It was a great act of Christian witness. And I think beyond that, when you start comparing that to the history that students get in public schools, you have, you know, in Berkeley or where I live in Vermont, we have schools that challenge the legacy of Columbus Day. A lot of schools don't at all. They embrace it. This is not part of our education. The history of America as a place that is founded with this original sin, not only of slavery, but of Native American genocide, that's something we on the left are familiar with. That's not mainstream history yet at all. Long way to go.
Well, I can't believe the show's over. This just flew by so quickly. But Rochelle, final thoughts from you, about 30 seconds.
The biggest thing I can do is to remind people that every time they see these things, remember that they're all symptoms of a problem that America has never dealt with. Maybe now we will.
Mm. Let's hope. Rochelle Riley is an award-winning columnist with the Detroit Free Press. Check out her forthcoming book, The Burden, African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery. Jeff Charlotte is Associate Professor of Literary Journalism at Dartmouth, and we've had him on talking about his bestsellers, The Family and C Street. Jeff has been reporting on these issues for 16 years. Rochelle and Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.